Welcome. This is our 30th Faith Angle Forum. We've been doing this now for 18 years. And we first began in 1999. We have some people here who were actually at the first Faith Angle. Michelle Cottle, Andy Ferguson, EJ, were you at the first one? In Maine. We held these in Maine, on the coast of Maine, twice. Our third one was planned for Protsnek, Maine. It was 2 weeks after 9/11, and we had to cancel, obviously, because all the airports, remember, for some of you who are old enough to remember, the airports closed down, and so we had to cancel the meeting, and I contacted the Pew Foundation, had been very generous, and I contacted them, and I said, we had to cancel the meeting, and they said, well, Michael, we don't want the money back, so you got to have a meeting somewhere, and so I said, okay, we'll go to Florida in the winter. And we went to Key West, and I'll never forget EJ coming up the stairs there at that reception, and you said, Mike, Maine is really nice, but Key West in the winter you can't beat. So we did it in Key West for about 5 years or 6 years, and then the only complaint from EJ and from Jeff Goldberg and David Brooks was, this is hard to get to. Once you get here, it's great, but it's not easy. So can you find something in Miami? And we did, and we found this place, and we've been here for, I think, maybe 6 years. And so from Maine to Key West to South Beach, we like to hold them in a place that you would like to visit. So we're glad you're here. Now, for those of you who are new, if this is your first forum, here's some simple ground rules. After our speakers present, I keep a running list of people who want to get in. And so you just signal me. Make sure you see we make eye contact, and I make a list of people who want to get in. Some of you are veterans, and I know right when our speaker begins, you'll start raising your hand just so you can get in the list, but that's not quite fair. But do it anyway. We then move along with great order and civility, and I just want to say right now, please silence your cell phones. That would be a great favor. And then the other thing is this. When I do call on you, we record the entire event. As you know, we then transcribe it. It goes up on our website. We've moved from just transcription, and now we have audio versions, and now we have video versions of our conversation. Everything is on the record, except when you say, I would really like this to be off the record. And then the person who's recording knows to not transcribe it. Yes, that. So, but let me say, when I do call on you, right now, if the microphone you have in front of you, the green light should not be on. But when I do call on you, press the button and the green light will come on and we'll get the recording. Oh. If all the green lights are on, we'll get a lot of reverb and it doesn't help. So keep those off, if you would. Try as best as you can to limit side conversations while we're in dialogue because it's distracting to others. And then finally, let me say, we've now moved into the new era. You can tweet away on what's being said. In fact, some of our donors like to see all the tweets that you send, so feel free to tweet away. Our hashtag is in your brochure, but I'll tell you, it's hashtag FaithAngle17. Hashtag FaithAngle17. It's also in your brochure there. Now, I want to introduce our speaker. Say it again, EJ.
It has occasionally trended FaithAngle.
It did last time, yes. So, trend away. Now, let me just say, I'll introduce our speaker. I'm not one of those, though, Howard. You've got these, and you've read her entire bio. I will not then read it back to you, simply to say that Professor Brakus, I got it right the first time, Brakus, you may not know, was named the Harvard Divinity School Outstanding Teacher of the Year in 2014 and 15. She did her PhD at Yale. Her undergrad was at Harvard. And on this topic, some of you have never been before. What we do is 4 months out, I meet with EJ and Will and Karen and Andy Ferguson and others, we have a discussion about what should we be talking about at the next faith angle at the intersection of religion and public life. And I believe it was Will said we really need to talk about religion and nationalism. And one of our speakers at our last faith angle, Grant Wacker, said the best person on this subject is our speaker today. And not only is she good on it, but she's writing a new book on it called Chosen Nation, Christianity and Politics and American Destiny. So when will your book be out?
So this is a wonderful opportunity for me because I am going on sabbatical next year to work on this book. So I have taught two courses about this and have written a little bit, but there is no.
So this is a trial run.
This is a trial run. I'm really looking forward to hearing comments and questions because it will definitely help me.
This is a great group to do a trial run. So thank you, Professor, for joining us. When she finishes, then we'll have our Q&A. Thank you for coming to the Faith Angle.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This really is a wonderful opportunity for me at maybe not the beginning of a project, but close to the beginning of a project. This is a book that I have been thinking about for a few years, and I have been teaching about it. And so next year when I'm on sabbatical, most of my time will be spent working on this. So I'm really fascinated by the way that Americans from the colonial period to the present have imagined the nation in religious terms. So you're going to hear some of those terms today. America has been imagined as a new Israel, a redeemer nation, a promised land. And so I'm interested in asking about the historical roots of this language, how the understanding of American chosenness has changed over time, and also what the ethical and religious implications of this belief, what those are. So there are really two sides to this question. How has Christian language influenced American politics? And that's mostly what I'm going to talk about today. But I'm also interested in how the belief in American chosenness has influenced American Christianity. And I do think there's been a dialectic here. And so I can say more about that in the Q&A. So if this were a class at Harvard Divinity School, you would be interrupting me all the time. I never really lecture all the way through. So I just wanted to let you know there are a lot of slides I'm going to be showing you. Some of what I'm talking about is really best conveyed through images. And we can go back to any of these in the Q&A because I suspect you're going to have some questions about some of them. So let me start at the beginning. In 1630, John Winthrop, one of the founders of Massachusetts Bay, wrote a lay sermon that he called A Model of Christian Charity. This is, you're seeing the manuscript behind me, a sermon that he may have delivered aboard the Arbella, the ship that brought the Puritans across the sea to New England. There are many mysteries about this sermon. Winthrop's descendants claimed that he wrote it during his journey to Massachusetts Bay, but it's also possible that he may have delivered it before the Arbella departed England. We're not even certain that Winthrop ever preached it. He may have written it and just put it aside. But one thing is clear. Winthrop's words reflected the Puritans' understanding of themselves as a chosen people in covenant with God. Borrowing an image from the Gospel of Matthew, Winthrop portrayed New England as a city on a hill. And here's Winthrop. For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill, he preached. The eyes of all people are upon us. Winthrop suggested that the Puritans, like the biblical Israelites, had been given a special commission as God's covenant people. They were his chosen. Yet instead of sounding triumphalist, Winthrop claimed that the Puritans' covenant with God was a burden as well as a blessing. To be a city on a hill was to be called to practice a radical form of Christian love. Echoing the Apostle Paul's evocative language of Christians as the body of Christ, Winthrop told the company of emigrants that they must put aside their individual interests in the service of a common good. We must be knit together in this work as one man, he preached. We must entertain each other in brotherly affection. We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities for the supply of others' necessities. We must uphold a familiar commerce together in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberality. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together. Always having before our eyes our commission and community in the work as members of the same body. Since Winthrop worried that the Puritans would face economic hardship as they tried to build a new community in the wilderness, he urged them to remember that their wealth ultimately belonged to God. In ordinary times, families were required to give only out of their abundance, but in extraordinary times, they were called to share their wealth with those who were suffering. He urged the Puritans to be merciful to one another, lending to the poor without expectation of being paid back. If thy brother be in want and thou canst help him, thou needst not make doubt what thou shouldst do. If thou lovest God, thou must help him. Quoting from the Gospel of Matthew, he preached, "Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth." Winthrop explained that if the Puritans could live up to this demanding vision of Christian charity, God would shower them with his grace. The Lord will be our God and delight to dwell among us as his own people and will command a blessing upon us in all our ways. But if they were sinful or disobedient, they would be punished just as the biblical Israelites had been. Because of his close reading of the Hebrew Bible, Winthrop believed that chosenness included suffering, punishment, and sacrifice. Instead of predicting a glorious destiny for God's new city on a hill, he ended his sermon with words of warning. "So that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world. We shall open the mouths of enemies to speak evil of the ways of God and all professors for God's sake. We shall shame the faces of many of God's worthy servants and cause their prayers to be turned into curses upon us till we be consumed out of the good land where we are going." Winthrop's vision of Massachusetts Bay was both sobering and inspiring. Urging Puritan women, men, and children to see themselves as a collective, he promised that they would share one another's blessings and burdens. Yet his inspiring vision of unity had limits. Though Winthrop never explicitly mentioned Native Americans, he implied that not everyone was worthy of Christian charity. Emphasizing the importance of obedience to God, he mentioned that when Saul failed to obey every part of God's commission to destroy the nation of Amalek, Saul was supposed to kill every man, woman, child, and animal, he lost his kingdom. In Winthrop's version of the city on a hill, the same God who demanded self-sacrificing love could also call his chosen people to exterminate the native inhabitants of the land. This is a slide of drawing by Captain John Underhill of the Pequot War of 1637, which Winthrop sanctioned. Puritans and their Narragansett allies surrounded a Pequot village in Mystic, Connecticut, and burned it and killed between 400 and 700 Native Americans who were trapped inside the village. What you can see in this circle is how both the Puritans and their Native American allies surrounded this village. The Native Americans who survived were either taken captive by the Narragansetts or sold into slavery in the West Indies. So this is the other side of Puritan city on a hill. From the very beginning, the faith in American chosenness was intertwined with violence. When Winthrop and the Puritans declared that Massachusetts Bay was a city on a hill, They never dreamed that their language would someday be invoked to describe a new nation. But 140 years later, a new understanding of American sacred destiny was forged in the crucible of the American Revolution. During the Revolutionary period, colonial Americans fused Christianity with a new spirit of nationalism to make an astonishing claim. God had chosen the colonies to become a beacon of democracy to the rest of the world. The city on a hill had become the new Israel, a nation, not just a religious community, in covenant with God. Since there was nothing inevitable about the transformation of the Puritan language of chosenness into a defense of Republican government, it's worth asking how this happened. The answer is that political and religious leaders drew on America's central text, the Bible, to argue that Scripture pointed toward America's special destiny. The Bible was the best-selling book in early America, and its influence was inescapable. Children learned how to read using the Bible, legal codes were based on biblical law, and even those who were not particularly religious knew its stories by heart. Revolutionary leaders, both ministers and politicians, rewrote the Exodus narrative of the Hebrew Bible as a story about American destiny. They retold the biblical story of Pharaoh, who had enslaved and oppressed the Israelites until Moses led them to freedom, as a foreshadowing of the American Revolution. Here we have the Reverend Nicholas Street's tract, his sermon, The American States, acting over the part of the children of Israel in the wilderness. Street placed America within biblical history by describing King George III as Pharaoh and the colonists as the oppressed Israelites. Street explained to his congregation that, quote, "The British tyrant is only acting over the same wicked and cruel part that Pharaoh, king of Egypt, acted toward the children of Israel above 3,000 years ago." Even Benjamin Franklin, who might be best described as a deist, conflated the story of the Revolution with Exodus. In 1774, when Congress considered creating a new seal for the United States, Franklin suggested that it should be an image of, quote, "Moses lifting up his wand and dividing the Red Sea, and Pharaoh in his chariot overwhelmed with waters." Here you can see the proposed seal of the United States. He wanted the seal to include the motto, "Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God." In addition to describing America as the new Israel, political and religious leaders also overcame long-standing suspicions of democracy to argue that the Bible revealed the superiority of a republican form of government, and I mean Republican with a small r. This was really a startling and remarkable development. When I teach about early America to students and they're reading sermons and other kinds of documents from the 17th century, they're always really surprised by how hostile Puritans were to the whole idea of democracy, which they associated with mobocracy or anarchy. But during the Revolution, Puritans changed their mind. They claimed not only that God had chosen America to be a new Israel, but also that God wanted the nation to be a beacon of democracy for the rest of the world. Since the Bible is full of affirmative statements about monarchy, including Peter's words, "Fear God, honor the king," revolutionary ministers struggled to turn Scripture into a defense of liberty. They were especially troubled by Paul's injunction to the Romans, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation." This is a powerful text. But by comparing Paul's letter to the Romans to his letter to the Galatians, patriotic ministers argued that Paul had been misunderstood. transforming him into an apostle of liberty, they argued that the central meaning of his writings was the importance of freedom. And so here you have Galatians, "Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free." Since there are relatively few biblical texts that include the words freedom or liberty, Paul's words became a crucial defense for the legitimacy of the revolution and more broadly for American democracy. Revolutionary ministers not only linked Christianity to democracy, but also to commercial success, predicting that God's new Israel would stand at the vanguard of commerce and technological innovation. I want to emphasize this because many of my students assume that the sort of commercial language was a result of industrial capitalism, but actually we can find the idea that prosperity was linked to American destiny all the way back in the revolutionary period. So here we have Ezra Stiles, the very benign-looking president of Yale. In 1783, Ezra Stiles, who was also a Congregationalist minister, delivered a sermon asserting that the new United States was God's new Israel, a beacon of Christian virtue, political freedom, and prosperity. Here is his sermon, "The United States Elevated to Glory and Honor." In that sermon, he said, "We shall have a communication with all nations in commerce, manners, and science beyond anything heretofore known in the world." The pride of these early Americans is astonishing because it was not at all clear that this little backwater of 13 colonies was going to become a major world power in 1776. Stiles's language was explicitly Christian, but his faith in America's sacred destiny was shared even by those who were skeptical of institutional religion. Thomas Paine, for example, described the revolution as the birthday of a new world. And here's Thomas Jefferson, who in his first inaugural in 1801 described the United States as the world's best hope. As these examples show, the roots of the belief in America's chosenness lie in the Revolutionary era, when both leaders and ordinary people claimed that God had destined the United States to stand as a beacon of Christian virtue, democracy, capitalism, and technological success. Besides imagining the U.S. as a new Israel, patriots saw the nation's founders as the fulfillment of biblical types. Ezra Stiles called George Washington this American Joshua, referring to the biblical Joshua who had led the Israelites into the land of Canaan. And after Washington's death in 1799, many Americans imagined him as a prophet or even as Jesus, a savior who had led the nation toward its sacred destiny. So behind me you see David Edwin's Apotheosis of Washington, an engraving from 1800. If you can see the two figures in the background, these are two of his revolutionary generals who were waiting to welcome him into heaven. This is John James Barillet's The Apotheosis of Washington, or The Commemoration of Washington from 1802, which was reproduced in many forms. You can find this image on painted glass, on creamware, and I think it's really a kind of extraordinary image. You can see that Father Time is lifting up Washington to take him to heaven. We have three women on the side. These are Faith, Hope, and Charity, who are grieving. And then I think one of the most remarkable pieces in this picture is the image of the Native American in the front who is slumped over grieving. For those of you who know anything about Native American history, the revolution was really a disaster for them. They had maintained a certain degree of autonomy by playing the French and the British against each other. And with the revolution, they were put in a really perilous political situation. So there were not too many Native Americans who were grieving over Washington's death, but this is part of the mythology of America. The identification of the United States as a chosen nation only grew stronger during the 19th century. In 1845, for example, John O'Sullivan, a journalist, published an influential article arguing that God had destined the nation to expand across the entire North American continent to encompass both Mexico and Canada. Kate, we were coming for you. Coining the term manifest destiny, he argued that there was no doubt of the, quote, manifest destiny of Providence in regard to the occupation of this continent. God wanted Americans to spread both Christianity and democracy across the continent and eventually the globe. So when John Gast, an artist, displayed his painting American Progress in 1872, he suggested that American expansion was part of God's plan. The nation's progress, whether in terms of education, technology, or civilization, as understood in the 19th century, was inevitable. This is really, I think, a remarkable painting with American Progress, symbolized as this woman who, I don't know how her gown is staying on, but you should notice that she's holding two things. She's holding a school book in one hand, which is a symbol of spreading education, and she also has a telegraph line in her hand, which is representing technological progress. We can see the railroad coming, we see farmers cultivating the land, and you can see that Native Americans are fleeing as progress is coming across the land. During the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the faith in American chosenness was used to justify not only westward expansion, but also military intervention in places like the Philippines, Puerto Rico, and Cuba. In 1900, for example, Albert Beveridge, a Republican senator from Indiana, delivered a speech entitled The Star of Empire that described the United States as, quote, the master nation of the world. Everybody should read this text. It's really remarkable. According to Beveridge, God had ordained the United States to spread democracy across the globe, and it was futile to resist God's will. This is a destiny neither vague nor undesirable, he proclaimed. It is definite, splendid, and holy. The American Republic, he wrote, will preside as the most powerful of powers and the most righteous of judges. Though Beveridge was known for his zeal in pursuing social reform, including the abolition of child labor, he perpetuated stereotypes of Filipinos, Cubans, and Puerto Ricans as ignorant, dark-skinned savages who are incapable of governing themselves. This is a cartoon from the 1898 Minneapolis Journal. Like John Gast, who depicted Indians fleeing from progress, Beveridge identified the nation's chosenness with the spread of white Christian civilization. He argued that Anglo-Saxons represented the pinnacle of evolutionary progress. If racist understandings of America's special relationship to God were used to justify intervention abroad, they proved especially powerful when turned against African Americans at home. Today, the Ku Klux Klan tends to be portrayed as a fringe movement. But in 1924, the Klan numbered more than 4 million members, and they identified themselves as the defenders of God's special relationship with the United States. Choosing a fiery cross as their symbol and limiting membership to white Protestant men, the Klan argued that they had been called to save the nation from blacks, Catholics, and Jews. This is an AP photo from 1925. This image shows a ceremony in which 800 new members were accepted into the Klan. Notice the cross with the flag on it. And I partially chose this image because it's from Los Angeles. I think this is in LA. I think people tend to assume that images like this come from, I don't know, Alabama or somewhere, but no, this is from Los Angeles in 1925. When new members were initiated into the order, they placed their hands on a Bible that lay on top of an American flag. The United States was God's chosen nation, and according to the Klan, God wanted the nation to be white and Protestant, not even Christian, but Protestant. If I've emphasized the close relationship between imperialism, racism, and the belief in American chosenness, it is because this part of our nation's history has sometimes been suppressed. Americans do not like to remember that John Winthrop wondered whether the city on a hill would ever be called to genocide. Yet this has been only a part of the history of American chosenness. Many Americans, especially those committed to greater rights for indigenous peoples, African Americans, immigrants, and women of all races, have used the idea of American chosenness to demand greater inclusion and justice. In the late 18th century, for example, Phyllis Wheatley, an enslaved woman, mocked Americans for portraying themselves as God's chosen nation. On the contrary, she argued, revolutionary patriots were modern Egyptians who had enslaved innocent Africans just as Pharaoh had enslaved the Israelites. Nevertheless, Wheatley clung to her faith that God had destined the United States for something better than slaveholding. Describing America as Columbia, she wrote in 1784, auspicious heaven shall fill with favoring gales wherever Columbia spreads her swelling sails. To every realm shall peace her charms display, and heavenly freedom spread her gold ray. According to Wheatley, God had chosen America to spread both Christianity and the spirit of liberty. For those of you who might never have met Phyllis Wheatley, so to speak, before, she was the first African-American woman to be published as a poet. Her story is really extraordinary. She arrived from Africa as a slave at the age of either 7 or 8. She arrived on a boat called the Phyllis, and she was bought by the Wheatley family, a wealthy family in Boston, who decided to call her after the boat on which she came. They quickly discovered that she was a very smart person and allowed one of their daughters to educate her. And so her poetry is really extraordinary for the depth of its classical allusions. She knew Latin, Greek mythology. This book was published in London because the Wheatley family could not find an American publisher who was willing to publish the words of a slave. And if you turn over, if you ever see an original copy of this, on the frontispiece, there is a testimonial signed by 18 of the most distinguished men in Boston swearing that she herself had written these poems, because nobody really believed it. The signatories included John Hancock. You can see that the way that she has presented herself, this engraving actually was done by another slave, and she is, I think, the antithesis of the way that Americans imagined black women in the late 18th century. Black women were sexually exploited on plantations. They were often described as sort of oversexed or naturally licentious. And here is Phyllis Wheatley looking very modest with the pen in her hand and a Bible at her elbow. And I think she's an extraordinary example of both the critique of the idea of American chosenness, but by the way it could get refashioned to serve the ends of freedom from slavery. In 1832, Mariah Stewart, a free black woman in Boston and an abolitionist, was scathing in her denunciation of the United States, which she described not as a city on a hill, but as the great city of Babylon. "Oh, America," she lamented in a speech, "America, foul and indelible is thy stain. Dark and dismal is the cloud that hangs over thee for thy cruel wrongs and injuries to the fallen sons of Africa. The blood of her murdered ones cries to heaven for vengeance against thee. Thou art almost become drunken with the blood of her slain. Thou hast enriched thyself through her toils and labors. The biblically literate here among you will recognize Stuart's comparison of the United States to the whore of Babylon. Like John Winthrop, Stuart warned that sinners who failed to keep God's commandments would be punished. Yet Stuart did not simply prophesy destruction. She believed that God had destined African Americans to teach the United States the true meaning of freedom. Like Wheatley, she believed that the United States was God's chosen nation, but she identified blacks, not whites, as the chosen people who were destined to turn America into an example for the rest of the world. Perhaps more than anyone else in American history, Martin Luther King Jr. revealed the revolutionary potential of the belief in American chosenness. Arguing against the Ku Klux Klan, who argued that God wanted America to be a white nation, King insisted that God had chosen America to be a model of racial reconciliation and equality. This is a picture of King kneeling in prayer in Birmingham in 1963 before going to jail. When King protested against segregation, he clothed his radical vision in the familiar, reassuring garb of America's sacred destiny. In his letter from Birmingham jail, he testified, "I hope the church as a whole will meet the challenge of this decisive hour. But even if the church does not come to the aid of justice, I have no despair about the future. I have no fear about the outcome of our struggle in Birmingham, even if our motives are presently misunderstood. We will reach the goal of freedom in Birmingham and all over the nation because the goal of America is freedom. Abused and scorned though we may be, our destiny is tied up with the destiny of America. We will win our freedom because the sacred heritage of our nation and the eternal will of God are embodied in our echoing demands." The motto of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was to redeem the soul of America. The similarities between King's language and the language of the Ku Klux Klan reveals that the belief in American chosenness has been widely shared by Americans with competing visions of the nation. Imagining America as a city on a hill, a new Israel, or a redeemer nation has been part of a tradition of consensus. On one hand, this consensus may have served to stifle dissent. There have been relatively few Malcolm X's in American history who have condemned Americans for their belief in their special relationship to God. On the other hand, the consensus about American chosenness also seems to have helped to mediate change, holding the nation together as Americans have embraced revolutionary movements like feminism and civil rights. This is the dynamic that really fascinates me. I think that reformers have been able to create change by appealing to a shared language of chosenness. The poet Audre Lorde famously argued that, quote, "The master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. They may allow us to temporarily beat him at his own game, but they will never enable us to bring about genuine change." Though I understand her despair, I hope that ultimately she is wrong. Abolitionists, feminists, and civil rights leaders may not have been completely successful in using the master's tools to dismantle the master's house, but they have indeed brought about genuine change, building a better nation around a commitment to American freedom. Since the 1980s, the language of American chosenness has been associated most closely with the political right, especially Ronald Reagan and the Christian conservatives who supported him. Though Reagan was not a churchgoer, he often spoke about his Christian beliefs, and he cherished John Winthrop's image of America as a city on a hill. The image wasn't quite enough for him. He changed it to a shining city on a hill. In 1974, during a riveting speech at the Conservative Political Action Conference, Reagan argued that the United States stood as a beacon of freedom and prosperity to the rest of the world. You can call it mysticism if you want to, he explained, but I have always believed that there was some divine plan that placed this great continent between two oceans to be sought out by those who were possessed of an abiding love of freedom and a special kind of courage. Quoting John Winthrop's words, he urged Americans to imagine themselves as a city on a hill, a model for the rest of the world. After his election as president, Reagan frequently described the United States as a city on a hill. It was one of his favorite images. During his farewell presidential address in 1998, he reminded Americans that they lived in a free, prosperous nation that had been specially blessed by God. I'm going to show you a little clip of his speech. I just want to make it clear ahead of time that since I'm not very technologically sophisticated, I gave the link to someone at Harvard Divinity School in the tech department to download it, and I had not listened to the whole link and did not realize it contains music. So this swelling music in the background is not something that I added, so just so you know.
And that's about all I have to say tonight, except for one thing. The past few days, when I've been at that window upstairs, I've thought a bit of the shining city upon a hill. The phrase comes from John Winthrop, who wrote it to describe the America he imagined. What he imagined was important because he was an early pilgrim, an early freedom man. He journeyed here on what today we'd call a little wooden boat. And like the other pilgrims, he was looking for a home that would be free. I've spoken of the shining city all my political life, but I don't know if I ever quite communicated what I saw when I said it. But in my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds living in harmony and peace. A city with pre-ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here. That's how I saw it and see it still. And how.
I'll stop there. This is really an extraordinary clip. In some ways, Reagan's language harked back to early America, but his understanding of God's will focused particularly on capitalism and free trade. The city on a hill was a city of immigrants, a city of commerce, open doors, and free ports, a city without walls. When I went to find this clip, I had forgotten his comments about without walls, and it really sort of shocked me. So there's your hashtag. If Reagan's vision of American chosenness focused mostly on commerce, his evangelical and fundamentalist supporters were more committed to portraying the United States as an explicitly Christian nation. And today, Christian conservatives continue to argue that the nation enjoys a special relationship with God. For example, consider the American Patriots Bible, a version of the Bible published in 2009 by Thomas Nelson, an evangelical publishing house. Edited by Richard Lee, an evangelical pastor and a trustee of Liberty University, the American Patriots Bible reprints the full text of the Bible with glossy inserts celebrating the history of American freedom. There are boxes inside of the text about the United States. As an advertisement explains, the Patriots Bible, quote, shows how a light from above shaped our nation. So this is what the page from the beginning of Genesis looks like. You can see some images of American soldiers. It's either the Arbella or the Mayflower. These are juxtaposed to the account of creation. So we have the creation of the nation and the creation of the world. The impact of this, when you see the entire text, is that America becomes part of sacred writ. Like the Revolutionary-era ministers who rewrote the Bible as a story about the United States, Lee highlights the parallels between the book of Exodus and American history. For example, he explains that the flight of the pilgrims, quote, mirrored a much earlier Exodus, when God led the children of Israel out of the bondage and oppression of Egypt and into a land he had promised their forefather Abraham. He also identifies George Washington as the American Moses. According to Lee, God directly inspired the founders when they wrote the Constitution, which means that the Constitution, like the Bible, should be understood as sacred writ. Blessed by God, the United States is destined to bring freedom to the rest of the world. The page that describes the selling of Joseph into slavery. And you can see there's a little box about freedom, and this account is juxtaposed to a quote from Dick Cheney. Many Christians have objected to the American Patriots Bible because of its exaltation of nationalism and violence. A reviewer in Christianity Today, an evangelical magazine, describes the book as idolatrous because of its insistence that, quote, God is uniquely invested and involved in America. One of the most striking things about the American Patriots Bible is its triumphalism. Unlike John Winthrop, who warned the Puritans about the perils of being a chosen people, the Patriots Bible has little to say about God's punishment of those who fail to uphold the common good. It has reportedly sold more than 125,000 copies, rising as high as number 5 on Amazon's bestseller list. The popularity of the American Patriots Bible reveals that large numbers of Americans continue to hold a Christian vision of American destiny. But in recent decades, as church membership rates have declined, the faith in American chosenness has begun to drift away from its Christian moorings. Today, most Americans seem less invested in defending the identity of the United States as an explicitly Christian nation than in asserting the nation's moral, political, and economic distinctiveness. Rather than describing America in religious language as a city on a hill, a new Israel, a promised land, or a redeemer nation, or in Abraham Lincoln's famous words, an almost chosen people, many Americans now describe the United States in less religious terms as exceptional, a term that seems designed to appeal to a religiously diverse population. Though Democrats and Republicans disagree on many things, most share a common faith in American exceptionalism. So here we have Sarah Palin praising Breitbart News for defending American exceptionalism. And here we have Hillary Clinton last summer, late August 2016, speaking at the American Legion's annual convention, where she defended the idea of American exceptionalism. She was speaking particularly against Donald Trump in that speech and criticizing his vision of the nation. And this brings us to Donald Trump. There were many surprises about Trump's election, but for me, one of the greatest was that Christian conservatives supported him despite his rejection of American exceptionalism. The 2016 Republican Party platform declared that, quote, our country holds a unique place in human history. But when Trump was asked in 2015 at a gathering of Texas Republicans how he planned to, quote, grow American exceptionalism, he responded that he didn't, quote, like the term. At that meeting, Trump argued that it's insulting to other countries to see the United States as superior to the rest of the world, and he also claimed that the nation's greatness had declined. This wasn't a new position for him. In 2013, when Vladimir Putin published an op-ed in the New York Times objecting to Barack Obama's description of the United States as exceptional, Trump strongly agreed with Putin. It's not clear to me whether Trump, who seems to have little religious grounding, knew what he was rejecting. but his Christian supporters have ignored his words. Many Christian conservatives argue that Trump, despite his own personal sinfulness, was chosen by God to further the nation's ministry or mission. They often compare him to David in the Bible, who had committed adultery. Like the Klan during the 1920s, they fear that God's chosen nation is endangered by outsiders, in this case, Mexicans and Muslims. I suspect that those of you around the table today have many different attitudes toward the idea of America as a chosen nation. Personally, I'm troubled by the hubris of imagining that the United States is specially chosen by God. There is only one Israel in the Bible. But I also admire the many abolitionists, women's rights activists, and civil rights leaders who demanded that the United States live up to its destiny. I can only hope that in the future, we will find ways to move beyond the troubling parts of American exceptionalism while still preserving the most inspiring parts of John Winthrop's vision of a city on a hill. So I'm going to give him the last word. After describing the Puritans as, quote, ligaments of one body, he wrote, "All the parts of the body being thus united are made so contiguous in a special relation as they must needs partake of each other's strength and infirmity, joy and sorrow, weal and woe. If one member suffers, all suffer with it. If one be in honor, all rejoice with it." This sensibleness and sympathy with each other's conditions will necessarily infuse into each part a native desire and endeavor to strengthen, defend, preserve, and comfort the other. This is what it meant to be chosen. "We must love one another with a pure heart, fervently," he wrote. "We must bear one another's burdens." Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.